From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Police in Baltimore have blocked off part of the 7th District to allow hundreds of residents to clean it up after last night's riots that followed the funeral of Freddie Gray, who died after being detained by police.
More National Guardsmen are headed to Baltimore. Nick Mosby is Baltimore City Councilor for the 7th District. And Councilman Mosby, I can't imagine your feelings as the sun rose today. Your thoughts?
Really concerned about my city. I think the immediate course of action, we need to defuse and de-escalate the situation. I'm glad that National Guard, and we've been dealing with jurisdictions of enforcement all the way up to Pennsylvania, have been here to help calm the situation. I think that that's the first immediate step that's needed. But, you know, just looking at the devastation in my district, looking at the issue that played out partially towards the end of Saturday and then basically all of yesterday starting around about 4 o'clock, you know, it's really heartbroken and troubling. You know, 90% of the protests to date has been very positive and very peaceful, you know, by members of our community who do not normally participate in demonstrations such as this. I mean, young folks will feel disenfranchised, feel voiceless, feel completely disconnected from the political process, and especially the systems and structure that have been put in place from a criminal perspective. But, you know, they've been speaking their minds, and like I said, majority of time it's been very positive and very productive. Unfortunately, last night's actions are going to completely overshadow. I don't condone any of that activity of violence and looting and burning of private property. However, I think it does send a gut check, not only to Baltimore, but urban America all throughout this country, that it's critically important that we listen to our children. I mean, you know, the anger and the frustration that we saw through their actions, again, should not be condoned, should not be tolerated, and must be addressed appropriately. However, after we get over this situation and we get some type of normalcy and some type of calm and we provide some type of justice or answers associated with this particular case, we really need to try to figure out how we can level set our priorities to ensure that we're providing them the best opportunity for the future. I think that this is what this is about. Freddie Gray's incident provided the culmination to decades-old frustration of anger, and they're living the sins of failed policies from the past decades today. And I think that this is their way of really speaking to folks. I mean, when you deal with folks who haven't been provided with the best educational system, when you're dealing with folks who haven't been provided with the best opportunities for gainful employment, you know, unfortunately, they don't have the ability of articulating their frustration, their anger, and I think they're showing it to us in violence.
Well, Councilman, tell us more about that, because last night there was a pretty extraordinary press conference with your mayor and other council members. One of them, Brandon Scott, came up and said, you know, I'm not going to be as nice as some others are saying in saying, as you just have, that some of our young people have issues. I'm ticked off. I'm paraphrasing him. And he called on adults to get out on the street and help the young people. He is also African-American, as you are, as your mayor is. Tell us more about, you know, the frustrations. This isn't these aren't young people pushing back on a white power structure as it might have been in Ferguson. What does the community have to do to bridge what seems in some cases like a generational divide?
It's not a generational divide. This has been going on for decades. I mean, this is, again, abject poverty, lack of resources, lack of opportunity, failing school systems, and folks who are just hurt and angry. And unfortunately, they're turning to violence to kind of put that on the playing field for the entire country, for the entire world to see.
Well, what do you think about them being called, even by your mayor, thugs?
I think that at this point, the criminal element needs to be addressed and dealt with. But I think for us to develop the healing process, for us to move forward, we really need to stay away from specific name calling, or, you know, I don't generally generalize or do that. I think that it's important for us to really, one, again, calm, de-escalate the situation, provide the proper resources to enforce the laws and ensuring that folks who are breaking the laws are punished. However, getting to these young adults, getting to these young folks, or speaking out through anger, through frustration, through violence.
No.
And it's not an easy thing to do. It starts with a healing process and relationships. But if we're truly serious about providing folks with real opportunities, if we're truly serious about growing urban America all across America, then we must address this very complex equation.
Yeah. That's Nick Mosby, Baltimore City Council member for the 7th District in West Baltimore. Nick Mosby, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Well, in Colorado, prosecutors called their first witnesses today in the trial of James Holmes, the man charged with murdering 12 people and injuring 70 others in a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado in 2012. In the years since, sadly, there have been a number of other mass shootings in this country.
A mass shooting at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin leaves at least 7 people dead.
The scene was the Washington Navy Yard in the nation's capital.
New details emerging about the deadly rampage near a California college.
The worst grade school shooting in U.S. history, at least 27 dead, 20 children, 7 adults.
In the aftermath of those murders, many of the victims' family members and others called for greater gun controls. But where have those efforts led? Robert Spitzer is chairman of the Political Science Department at SUNY Cortland. He's a visiting professor of government at Cornell University, and he's author of a new book, Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. He's with us now. Professor Spitzer, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
Well, in the 3 years since Aurora, and we've just heard there about all the other shootings that have happened since then, how successful have gun control advocates been? Has anything changed?
Nothing has changed at the federal level. In the aftermath, especially of the Sandy Hook shooting in December 2012, there was a real national sense that it was time to tighten up gun laws. President Obama made a concerted effort to do that in the spring of 2013, and that ultimately fell flat. But the other piece of this puzzle is that virtually every state became involved in gun policy in some important way, and at least a dozen states enacted laws to toughen gun regulations. On the other hand, twice as many states went in the other direction and enacted laws to weaken their existing state gun laws. So there's been a lot happening at the state level. That's where the action has been.
Well, let's get into both of those. First of all, the states that decided to toughen gun laws, what did they do?
Well, they did a variety of things. States have moved ahead on issues such as universal background checks, having tighter restrictions on people who have orders of protection against them or who are involved in domestic violence to make sure that they don't have guns, measures to restrict large capacity bullet magazines, which played an important role in a number of shootings in the last few years. So those are the kinds of measures we've seen in states that have gone towards stronger gun laws.
What about the states that have decided to weaken their gun laws?
A lot of states have done that, and they've done it in the context of already having fairly weak laws. Generally speaking, those changes were fairly small bore. That is saying, for example, that judges could carry firearms, that elected officials could carry firearms, by slightly expanding the options available to school teachers in a few states. By and large, those measures to weaken laws were, as much as anything, a political statement in more conservative states to affirm their idea that tougher gun laws really are not helpful, don't improve the situation, and that they wanted to be on record as supporting gun rights instead.
What about the power of the gun lobby? A lot of people are going to hear what you're saying there, that while about a dozen states enacted tighter gun restrictions in the last many years, that twice as many states did the opposite. And they'll think, well, that's because the NRA is so powerful. Could any politician ever stand up to the NRA and win?
Well, the short answer is yes. Certainly the gun lobby headed by the National Rifle Association is very powerful, very influential. They've been in this business for many years, pursuing an aggressive gun rights agenda. But the changes in laws we've seen in the states in recent years have occurred in states that are gun-friendly to begin with, that are pretty conservative anyway. So it didn't involve any great or Herculean political effort for the gun lobby to advance their interests in those states. It's also important to note that we've seen something new in the last 2, 3, 4 years, which is the rise of some new gun control groups which are different from what we've seen in the past, because first, they're extremely well-funded, and secondly, they're working assiduously to build real grassroots support around the country, which is one thing that the NRA has had for many, many decades that the pro-gun control side hasn't really had. So former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's group originally founded as Mayors Against Illegal Guns, is now a larger, more encompassing pro-gun control group. You have former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly, who have formed a pro-gun control group, in the context of which, though, they note that they are gun owners, that they, you know, are familiar with the use of firearms, and they're not trying to obliterate firearms from the American presence. But these groups are extremely well-funded and, in fact, for the first time in history, in the recent election cycle, actually outspent the NRA, something that's never happened before. And they seem to be in this for the long term. And if they maintain levels of spending and fundraising, if they're able to rally more grassroots support consistently around the country, that could be a game-changing moment for the politics of gun control.
That's Robert Spitzer, the chairman of the political science department at SUNY Cortland. He's also author of Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. Robert Spitzer, thanks for joining us.
Real pleasure to speak with you.
In Grand Rapids, Michigan this week, historians are meeting to discuss one part of American history they say has long been neglected, the Midwest, states from Ohio to Illinois to Minnesota and Missouri. Joining us now are two historians participating in the conference, Pamela Riney-Kerberg, who chairs the Department of History at Iowa State University. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And John Lauck is also with us. He's a co-organizer of the conference, author of several books on Midwest history, including The Lost Region. He teaches the history of the Midwest. And John Lauck, start us off. Why have this conference? This is obviously something that matters a lot to you.
Well, we started a couple of years ago pushing for more attention to the history of the Midwest. We formed an organization, and we've tried to get people to write more books and articles about the Midwest. And the next logical step is to have a big conclave of people who are interested in this initiative and bring them together. And hopefully people outside the region can hear about our cause.
Well, why do you have that cause? Why do you think that the Midwest and the history of the Midwest is being forgotten?
Unfortunately, given the shuffling that's gone on in the academic world in the last 50 years or so, the Midwest has disappeared from the discipline of history. It used to be a very vibrant field that had a major organization behind it and many journals that focused on the Midwest. But for a variety of reasons over the last 20 years, all of that collapsed, and all the institutional supports which were once there for Midwestern history have gone into decline.
Well, where do you begin when you start to tell the story of the Midwest?
If you want to study the Midwest, you begin at the American Revolution, because the American Midwest formally began with the Northwest Ordinance, at least I argue. Now, of course, there's a very interesting prehistory here involving the battles among various imperial powers, British, French, Spanish, Native American, and all of this came together. All of these historical events led to this moment in 1787 when this brand new American government began to organize this big space that we now know of as the American Midwest.
Pamela Riney-Kerberg, why did you get involved in this, and what is the story that you want to tell about the history of the Midwest?
I got involved with Midwestern history simply as a matter of where I was living. I grew up on the Great Plains, but went to graduate school in the Midwest and somehow ended up living then for 30 years in the Midwest and became interested in the place where I lived and the communities that formed the agricultural heartland. I'm a rural and agricultural historian, and there's really no better place to study that particular history.
And one wonders how long that will last. How long do you think agriculture is going to be so critical to the economy of the Midwest and the identity of the Midwest?
Well, I don't think you can get away from it being critical to the economy of the Midwest. Whether it's small farmers growing grain or much larger farmers growing grain, we have not outgrown our need for grain and our need for food and fuel. And how that agriculture is carried out is going to change, but its degree of importance probably won't, particularly when you look at what's happening with drought in California and the enormous amount of food that's imperiled by that drought there. We're going to have to be fed by another part of the country, and that other part of the country may very well be the Midwest.
How important has the Mississippi River been in shaping the history of the Midwest?
It's enormously important. All of that travel up and down, but also the enormous natural disasters along it that have shaped the landscape. It's definitely an important economic driver.
And full disclosure, by the way, I am from the Midwest myself. I am from central Illinois, which, by the way, has a very different history than Missouri or Iowa or where you are, John, in South Dakota. Can you really lump the Midwest together in that way?
Well, I think one of the defining features of the Midwest is its diversity. People think of the Midwest as this kind of homogeneous blob of white people. That's not true of the Midwest. This is a very multi-ethnic region, which involves a lot of different kinds of topography and plant life and geography and history. That's what makes it interesting. And in the 19th century, the Midwest was the most diverse region in the country, and it had the most number of immigrants, and it had the most different kinds of industry and farming and agriculture. And this story is just not well known.
Well, Pamela, what is the cultural identity, in your view, of somebody who was shaped by the Midwest? What is the historical image of a Midwesterner?
I think our Midwestern identity is very much shaped by place, by a set of cultural norms that are perhaps a little different than in other parts of the country. You know, many of the Midwestern states are characterized as nice states. There's Iowa nice, there's Minnesota nice. There's a cultural sensibility that I think really encourages us to be cognizant that other people are perhaps different than we are.
Well, and we think back over history and we think of some of the famous people that have come out of the Midwest. Of course, right now we're all talking about Abraham Lincoln because it's 150 years since his assassination. But also there are people like Mark Twain. What to you, John, is the ideal image of a Midwesterner over the course of history?
Well, I'm glad you brought up Abraham Lincoln. Of course, he's from your neck of the woods in southern Illinois, Jeremy, and I think he's really the first iconic Midwesterner, the first Midwesterner to become president of the United States, and the person who represented this new interior party, which kind of caught a wave in 1860 and ended up making a great deal of history, as we know. Unfortunately, we don't really get much beyond Abraham Lincoln when we think about the Midwest, and we don't think about the details of its history. From the very beginning, it was enshrined in the Northwest Ordinance that slavery would be prohibited in the territories or the ultimate states of the Midwest. Now, that doesn't mean that slavery was completely eliminated from the scene. There was some indentured servitude, and there was problems implementing this ban in the southern parts of the Midwest, southern Indiana, southern Illinois, etc. But it set the standard for the region. And so the Midwest, over time, became this destination for people escaping the South, for African Americans escaping the South. You may remember that famous scene from Uncle Tom's Cabin. The big goal was to race across the Ohio River so you could get into the Midwest and ultimately to freedom. And of course, the abolitionist movement was very strong in the Midwest, in Ohio and Iowa. And so this is a way of drawing out the contrast between regions in the United States, between the North and the South. If we knew our history better, if we knew where those fugitive slaves were trying to get, if we understood that region better, we'd understand the whole of our history a lot better.
Pamela, if there is a lesson that the rest of the nation can take from the history of the Midwest, what would you say that lesson is?
I think the Midwestern lesson is essentially about blooming where you're planted. That it has historically taken a lot of endurance, a lot of patience, a lot of hard work to do the work of the Midwest. You know, we're states of agriculture and states which were long known for heavy industry. But people put down roots. People had families. There are a lot of virtues to learning to bloom where you're planted and work hard and endure.
That's Pamela Riney-Kerberg, who chairs the Department of History at Iowa State University, joining us from Ames, Iowa. And we've been speaking with John Lauck, author of several books on the Midwest and its history, including The Lost Region. He was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They are both going to be participating in the Conference on Midwest History, which gets underway this week in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And one of the many big news stories we are following today, Supreme Court justices heard arguments concerning same-sex marriage in a case that could lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage across the country. The audio has been released, and we want to hear a bit of it right now. Here is attorney Mary Bonato arguing that laws banning same-sex marriage are unconstitutional. You'll hear Justice Antonin Scalia questioning her.
The thing about marriage is that it's controlled and regulated by the states. And, of course, we all know there are exclusions in cases like Loving and Zablocki and Turner, where in each case with prisoners, with people behind on their child support payments, with a mixed-race couple, and even though some of those exclusions were quite traditional, they could not stand.
Well, it was not all societies banned mixed-race marriages. In fact, not even all states. Do you know of any society prior to the Netherlands that permitted same-sex marriage?
As a legal matter, Your Honor?
As a legal matter.
I am not.
Not a single society until the Netherlands in 2001. You're telling me they were all, I don't know what.
No, what I'm saying is taking that tradition as it is, the court still needs a reason to maintain that tradition when it has the effect.
The issue, of course, is not whether there should be same-sex marriage, but who should decide the point.
Justice Antonin Scalia there talking with attorney Mary Bonato at the Supreme Court today as justices heard oral arguments about same-sex marriage. A decision in the case is expected in June.
Filmmaker and climber David Brashears is well aware of the dangers of Mount Everest. He's summited five times. He was there in 1996 when a blizzard killed eight climbers. His film about the Into Thin Air incident was the first IMAX film shot on the mountain. He was also there during last year's deadly avalanche. He used ropes to carry friends' bodies down. And he was part of the rescue again on Mount Everest after this weekend's earthquake triggered the avalanche at base camp. David was much higher, filming climate change effects for the group Glacier Works. He was coptered down to base camp where he's on his sat phone. David, you there?
I'm here, Robin.
Boy, as you well know, 18 died on the mountain, four Americans. Tremendous relief, I'm sure, for your many friends to hear your voice. But what are your feelings having survived this?
If someone would have said, you know, an avalanche would fall caused by an earthquake and kill people and literally obliterate camps. It looks like bombs went off here. I would have said it could never happen, but it did. It was just such terrible and sad news. And there's a very deep sense here that this tragedy is far wider than what and broader than what happened here at base camp. And we think every moment about the people of Nepal, especially the people living in the hills, who have been affected by this earthquake.
Well, you are one of the seasoned climbers who's become very close to the Sherpas, the local people who help you and others do what you do. What's been their reaction to this? I mean, it was Sherpas who died last year when there was an avalanche higher up on the mountain, and now this and their families below are suffering.
We were at Camp 1, and I was there with a Sherpa I worked with for years, Angfula. And the first thing Angfula wanted to do was to get on the sat phone and check with his wife, who was in his village home in the Khumbu region. And he wanted to talk to his 6-year-old and 8-year-old daughters who were in school in Kathmandu. And it was such a wonderful thing to hear him on the phone to his two daughters in school in Kathmandu.
Yeah. And just one last question, David. I don't want to use up too much of your sat phone, but, you know, we've spoken many times. I don't think I've ever heard you this subdued. I don't know if it's fatigue or shock or...
Well, it's just we were affected by this shaking of the earth and the snow rushed over us and we feared for our lives. And then it snowed and it really became quite a pristine and beautiful landscape at 19,800 feet. And when I got out of the helicopter at base camp to see just the devastation. People, you know, flung through the air, smashed against rocks. I'd never seen anything like that, and I'm thankful I wasn't here at base camp when that happened. And I'm thankful for all the people here, their magnificent effort, saving lives, and also to take care of the deceased, to get the bodies home. It was really, it's something I've never seen. It's the devastation, but also just the wonderful, magnificent work here done by people at base camp in a dire emergency.
David Brashears, thank you and take care.
Thank you, Robin.
David Brashears on Mount Everest, here and now. This morning, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan was at an intersection in Baltimore that was littered with burning cars last night, vowing to not leave the city unprotected. Baltimore already has a curfew for teens. Tonight, there's one for everyone, and National Guard troops have been deployed. At least 15 officers were hurt, and the number arrested is now over 200 after police and demonstrators clashed following yesterday's funeral for Freddie Gray, who died of an unexplained spinal injury a week after his arrest. Gerald Stansbury, the NAACP Maryland State Conference president, spoke at a press conference this morning.
Baltimore has a long history of police brutality and racial profiling, and Mr. Gray's death represents another example in a series of tragedies of black lives being lost at the hands of someone in blue uniforms.
The rioting was the worst violence of its kind in the U.S. since the protests over the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, last August. And that was one of the reasons we decided to track race relations this week. All week long, we've been thinking about President Abraham Lincoln's legacy on race by following the route of his funeral procession to Springfield, Illinois, 150 years after his death. Scott Trosel wrote a book about Lincoln's final journey home, and he told us what it was like in Indianapolis when the president's train arrived on April 30th, 1865.
And there was so much rain that the streets had turned into a sea of mud. It was ankle deep. So they decided they would take the coffin directly from Indianapolis Union Station over to the State House and commence the viewing immediately. And people stood in the rain. One of the reporters described them as looking like drowned rats.
But they had to be there. We're using Lincoln's final journey as a chance to reflect on modern-day race relations. Here now is Peter O'Dowd, has been following the rift between the black community and police while he travels the route. He reports from Indianapolis, a city struggling to contain a surge in violence among young black men.
Police department!
Officer Lona Douglas at work on the west side of Indianapolis. She's just entered a home with her gun drawn. There's no one inside, but Sherry King's door jamb is busted.
You work hard, you go to work, and this is what you come home to.
And her flat screen TV is gone.
I love my neighbors. They're old. They don't buy. They look out. You know what I mean? So I've never had an issue. Never. I guess somebody just taking their chances today to see how it goes.
Need to reach a shot fired at Warman. Both cars went the same direction with each other on 10th and then.
Back inside her patrol car, Officer Douglas says this neighborhood is one of six high crime areas that Indianapolis is trying to turn around.
But that's kind of why this area could be dangerous. One minute you're just taking a burglary report, the next minute you're responding to someone who's been shot.
Last year, police counted 138 murders in Indianapolis, up 44% from 2012. When police could identify suspects, they were far more likely to be young black men. And about 60% of the victims, also young black men. All this comes at a time when the nation is gripped by a debate over police tactics and the eroding trust between police and the black community. That's not lost on Officer Douglas, who's white.
Like, if I'm involved in a shooting, I feel like I'm going to be targeted at this point because it's what's going on in the nation. But my main priority is getting home to my family right now. So I'm going to do what I have to do to survive, and then I will explain it when the time comes.
For 20 years, Indianapolis didn't have this problem. 30 years.
Police Chief Rick Height blames the murders on the same kind of drug crimes that New York and other major cities went through in the 1980s.
So they've done a great job of staving it off. But now, because of the exposure of Indianapolis, the size of Indianapolis, people think they could come here and wreak havoc. That just won't happen.
We can't just judge our city's health on a homicide rate.
This is the chief's boss, Public Safety Director Troy Riggs.
We have to look at those root causes.
Riggs says more than 90% of the murders were committed by suspects with a criminal history, and 81% of the victims had a criminal record.
What that is telling us is that our police department is doing a very good job of arresting the right people, the violent offenders, only to see them getting back on the streets quickly.
I see a statue of Abraham Lincoln on your bookshelf there. What do you think Abraham Lincoln would say about the challenges that Indianapolis is facing?
The thing that I like about Lincoln and something that governs us is he had a way about him to bring people together. And even when he was insulted and people would come against him, he would turn the other cheek and move on because he thought the success of the Republic was more important than fighting amongst ourselves.
To that end, Riggs says police are collaborating with faith groups and nonprofits in the 6 targeted neighborhoods. They're pouring resources into conflict resolution skills, mental health care, and vacant housing. But all this opens up a more complicated conversation about class and race.
I would say that Indianapolis is a calm city for race relations, but as a 54-year-old white man who's a college professor, I might not be the best person to ask.
Indiana University religion professor Art Farnsley has been a close observer of the city for decades. In 1968, Robert Kennedy stood at the spot where we are now and told a mostly black crowd that Martin Luther King Jr. had just been assassinated.
It is not the end of lawlessness, and it's not the end of disorder. But the vast majority of white people and the vast majority of black people in this country want to live together, want to improve the quality of our life, and want justice for all human beings that abide in our land.
A plaque at the site says Kennedy's speech helped keep Indianapolis calm while other American cities broke out in riots. Today, Farnsley says the tension is subtle. To see it, drive along a major road called 38th Street.
There is a palpable difference when you cross 38th Street that the city switches from what you would primarily describe as an urban neighborhood with everything that entails to what's clearly an older, close to 100-year-old suburb, but with large, lovely brick houses and big lawns. And I like that neighborhood very much, by the way. I live in it.
But, he says, it's two neighboring worlds living separately.
I think it's easy enough to think that that's someplace completely different. Yeah, it's part of my city, but it's not really part of my community.
Those words echoed almost exactly by Reverend Charles Harrison.
Most people see this as a black problem. They don't see it as a community problem.
Harrison leads the 10-Point Coalition, a group that tries to calm street violence. We meet beneath the fluorescent lights of a gas station right on that line, 38th Street. Many nights, 10-Point deploys a faith walk from this spot when a conflict breaks out nearby. Police rely on 10-Point to be a liaison between cops and the community.
When we talk about black-on-black violence, it's about black criminals killing black criminals, drug dealers killing drug dealers, gang members killing gang members. And I think it does feed into the old stereotypes that this country has about black men.
Do you think that because of what's going on with the crime rates in Indianapolis, that it makes it more vulnerable to being the next Baltimore, the next Ferguson?
I think we are more vulnerable to becoming the next Baltimore or Ferguson if we don't address these root causes that's leading to this uptick of violence in the city.
Tonight, however, this part of town is quiet.
We are thrilled because nothing is happening.
Yes.
we are thrilled about that.
It's nearly midnight now, and 10-Point pastor Horatio Luster is leading a walk through a low-income apartment complex. When there's a murder, it's his job to put an arm around the grieving mother's shoulder.
Some of these people, the only church that they're going to see is when they see us.
Tonight, he just listens. As we talk, another member tells Luster that someone just got a tip from a resident. Something's going down tomorrow.
What was the tip?
Do we share or do we not?
Well, that's something that we need to kind of pass on. just that it would be a little, it won't be, let's put it like this, it won't be as peaceful out here tomorrow night as it is tonight.
Why do you think a young man would come up to one of your volunteers and share the information?
Establish relationship. A lot of people, they're sick and tired of the violence. And even though they may be out here, they're not necessarily a part of it.
And so they share, Luster says. It's a way to help. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Indianapolis.
And if you go to hereandnow.org, we'll link you to Tumblr, where Peter is posting lots of pictures of his trip.
This is Here and Now, and now that the last holdouts in the country, a.k.a. those of us here in the Northeast, are finally starting to feel like spring.
Because it's 40 degrees.
Finally. And we're not talking about Celsius. Let's get into Kathy Gunst, our resident chef, who is here to talk about some of the things we can eat in the spring. And Kathy, let's start with salads.
I'm so happy we're not talking about root vegetables
anymore.
Yeah, right.
Enough with that.
Well, it's happened. I mean, it is spring. We're all feeling excited about the possibilities. The markets are starting to fill up with seasonal foods. Our waistlines are feeling a bit extended. So we start to think about salads and even making them for main course meals. I have so many ideas for you, so let's just run right into it. Yeah. So you have a green salad in front of you, and these are tender baby spring leaves. There's some little arugula in there, but there's a surprise herb in there, and this is just a kind of trick that can make your food pop with
mint
flavor. Bingo!
So good.
Ding, 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 ding. Sorry, Robin, he beat you. I hope you get the next one.
I was going to say it, but my mouth is full.
So I just shred fresh mint leaves and put it in with any combination of lettuces or even just a plain old head of lettuce. Mm. That, to me, is like the taste of possibility and brightness and freshness and lightness, all the attributes of spring food. Mm-hmm. You also have a farro salad, as not in PH, but F-A-R-R-O. Farro is a whole wheat grain. It does have gluten. Many people think it's a gluten-free grain like quinoa, but it's not.
A relative of the wheat berry.
True enough. And I just steamed it with about 2 cups of water and a little salt, till it's mushy. A lot of people overcook it. The whole thing about farro is it has this wonderful bite. Mm. It should have a texture. And I took tiny little spring radishes, often the very first thing you see in the markets, often the very first thing you'll see in your own gardens. That's just the thrilling moment when the first radish pops up.
This is so good, Jeremy, the farro. We were researching, and apparently it was sort of farro because it was fed to Roman legions. And
oh, truly.
It's so crunchy and good.
Yeah, I just love the texture. And so I thought it needed a little bit of something. So I took very briny green olives and I pitted them and slivered them. And so you have the radishes and the olives. And then because I just cannot seem to cook without garlic, I took some garlic cloves and roasted them in a little olive oil, about 350 degrees for about 10 minutes, just till they get tender. And what happens to garlic when you roast it is it becomes sweet. Mm-hmm. So it's not a super assertive or, you know, flavoring anymore. It becomes, it's mellow. You taste it in there, right? But it's not like, whoa.
Delicious.
Speaking you also have an asparagus salad in here.
I do. And speaking of whoa, the asparagus salad has ramps in it. I've talked about that here before. Ramps are wild leeks. They are coming up in fields all across the eastern seaboard. In fact, in the south, they're already gone. But up north in Maine, in my secret patch, they are just starting.
I have a confession to make, which is that I did not know what ramps were until recently, and I had them, and they are so good.
Life-changing.
What would you compare them to for someone who hasn't had them yet? Either of you.
I think the whole point is that there's nothing comparable.
Like
it's like a scallion on fire. It's like
there you go.
Right?
You just did it.
It's so full of pow, but it's unlike anything else. Let's talk about asparagus for a minute. Some people like them thick. Some people like them thin. Mm-hmm. People are always asking me, what do you like? Well, I like them both. I love the tender ones, but they're delicious to grill. And the thick ones are much better for that because they're very juicy and they'll hold their shape and they can hold up to the heat of the grill. Love asparagus. These I roasted, which is another technique that we don't usually see for asparagus.
Well, and we've spoken of this before, but Jeremy, do you know some of the best asparagus in the world comes from a town called South Hadley in Western Mass?
Yes,
and I've gone out there, and they grow straight up out of the ground, and you have to snap them before the sun hits them and they wilt. They are amazing.
A fresh asparagus is probably the ultimate spring treat.
Yeah, they are delicious.
And they're on the East Coast again, just starting, and very exciting to see those. We're also seeing watercress, which we have year-round, but peak season for watercress, which is a peppery, slightly spicy, slightly bitter green. So delicious to throw into salads for a bit of that pepperiness. Very seasonal right now. And fava beans are on your asparagus salad.
These are fava beans.
They're lima beans. No, they're so tender and buttery. They're a very seasonal ingredient. People shy away from them because you have to peel them twice.
And because they saw a movie. Keep going.
Yeah, let's not go there. Okay. But these fava beans, they're huge. They come in these big pods. Sometimes they're literally like a ruler, a 12-inch long thing. You peel them open and there's the fava beans. You boil them for 1 minute, put them under cold water, and then you just pop the bean outside of that inner pod or shell.
Just delicious.
Buttery, right? These are wonderful flavors that make you want to eat healthy, eat seasonal, but, you know, feel good.
And we've got these recipes, by the way. Go ahead, listeners, crash our website as you always do when Kathy comes on. Hereandnow.org. We've got some of these recipes for salads.
And we want to take a second because she is so terrific. Kathy just won a James Beard Award for journalism in the home cooking category for her article, Cabbage Craft. Yes, she can do more with cabbage. And it appeared in Eating Well magazine. But we recommend all her writing, all her books. Please check Kathy Gunst out if you aren't already one of those who crashes the website to find out about her. Kathy, thanks as
thanks,
always.
Thanks, guys.
And congrats.
Thank you so much.
And here and now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Again, those recipes at hereandnow.org. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.